May it please the court. My name is Steve Jouard. I'm an attorney from Fort Collins, Colorado, and I represent the appellant and petitioner, Holly Hand, who is a claimant in a workers' compensation case. There are really three issues I'd like to focus on in terms of the oral argument. The first being whether or not the Industrial Claims Appeals Office erred in remanding this matter after a hearing conducted by ALJ Rumler, where there was clearly substantial evidence to support Judge Rumler's determination that the claimant was entitled to permanent total disability benefits. I'd also like to talk about whether or not Judge Rumler's error, if there was an error in her order, was harmless, given the fact that the vocational expert that testified on behalf of the respondents conceded that if you accepted the testimony of Dora Shriver in terms of the restrictions that the claimant had, that she agreed, in fact agreed, that the claimant was permanently and totally disabled. The third issue I'd like to address is whether or not the claimant was denied due process in terms of the reassignment of this matter to an ALJ that didn't hear any of the evidence, wasn't able to evaluate the credibility of any witness, and then issued an order where his findings were completely 180 degrees contrary to the judge that actually saw and took the testimony and evaluated the credibility of the witnesses. The initial hearing was conducted before Judge Rumler. It was a very contested hearing. Both sides introduced significant testimony. The claimant testified. The claimant's treating physician, who had been attending the claimant for 5 years, testified, Dr. Jonathan Woodcock, and Dora Shriver, a vocational expert and occupational therapist, testified both about her vocational opinions and her occupational therapy opinions in terms of what the claimant's residual functional capacities were as a result of her work injury. After that hearing, which also included a post-hearing deposition from another physician, which was considered by Judge Rumler, Judge Rumler issued her order, which is in the record on the CD at, I believe, pages 1674 to 1681. Judge Rumler made extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law. She determined, based upon evaluating the claimant's testimony, that the claimant was credible, that she believed, based upon the evidence, that if claimant could work, she would be working, and that she had demonstrated a commitment to work, even at hard labor, in the years leading up to her permanent disability. ALJ Rumler determined that Dr. Woodcock's testimony, who testified that the claimant was permanently and totally disabled, and who again had been the primary treating physician of the claimant for 4 years from the date that he took over care in 2003, she specifically determined that Dr. Woodcock's testimony also was credible and persuasive to her. She also determined that the testimony of Dora Shriver, who testified on behalf of the claimant, her testimony was also credible, and she determined in her order in paragraph 24 that each one of those witnesses' testimony was credible and persuasive. In fact, she referred to Dr. Woodcock's testimony, who was a Harvard-trained neurologist and psychiatrist, that his testimony was particularly persuasive to her. Despite Judge Rumler's determination, the ICAO focusing on...
Pardon me, Mr. Jouard. I'd like to, before we leave Judge Rumler's order, Judge Rumler's order says that he relied on Ms. Shriver's opinions rather than Ms. Montoya's because due to procedural difficulties with this case beyond the control of Ms. Montoya, she had only outdated physical restrictions for claimant on which to base her opinion.
Right.
Is it a fair reading of that statement that he said, basically, I'm not going to consider her at all because the basis for her opinion is not reliable? Is that a fair statement?
I don't think that's a fair statement. I think she considered both experts' testimony. I think what is missing is the context of that statement. And in fact, the evidence in the record is that Ms. Montoya actually identified three sets of restrictions that she relied upon. And she, again, conceded that if you accept Doris Shriver's statement of restrictions, that she agreed that the claimant was permanently and totally disabled. And she testified to that twice. It's in the record on page 1351. It's in the record on page 1355.
But she herself did not agree with that assessment, correct?
She said she did not rely upon it. Instead, she relied upon restrictions, and the first was provided by Dr. Lesnack. Well, Dr. Lesnack was present at the hearing. In fact, he was there for both days. The first day of the hearing, he passed notes to defense counsel to assist in cross-examination of Dr. Woodcock and of Doris Shriver. He testified at length in the hearing regarding what he felt were the appropriate restrictions, which obviously was different than the restrictions that Doris Shriver had determined, and it was in conflict with Dr. Woodcock's testimony. In her order, you will see that there is no reference, despite Dr. Lesnack's involvement in the hearing, there is no reference in ALJ Rumler's order with regard to Dr. Lesnack's testimony. She doesn't even mention him. What she does say is that I have not, where I have deemed the evidence not credible or not persuasive to me, I have not, you should consider it rejected. And that's one of her conclusions of law. So I think it's clear and implicit in her order that she rejected Dr. Lesnack's statement of restrictions. The other statement of restrictions that the respondent's vocational expert relied upon, or she testified she relied upon, was from a Dr. Lockwood. And Dr. Lockwood was a treating physician from way back, and Dr. Lockwood had last seen the claimant, I think April 6th of 2006, I believe. Prior to that time, Dr. Lockwood had not seen the claimant for over 2 years. I think it was 27 months. And he testified in his deposition, which is in the record, that when he saw Ms. Hand on in April of 2006, that he didn't even consider himself to be a treating physician. What he did on that day was just simply continue restrictions that he had imposed in 2002. Long before the claimant had even reached maximum medical improvement, and long before the claim had been reopened in 2004. Again, you can read, it's implicit in ALJ Rumler's order, that she rejected that statement of restrictions because she doesn't anywhere find those restrictions provided by Dr. Lockwood and then restated in 2006, she doesn't find them credible. So we're faced with a case where the claimant goes to hearing, every factual determination that can be made is in her favor. There are crucial credibility determinations that she makes. Every single one is in the favor of the claimant.
Now, okay? let me ask this, Mr. Girard, back to the statement that Judge Bernard referred to. In this case, turned for the panel, it turned on this one statement that Judge Rumler says Montoya had only outdated physical restrictions for claimant on which to base her opinion. And they're saying there's no record support for that statement. What's your position on whether, on the record before Judge Rumler, Montoya had not outdated, had physical restrictions that were not outdated?
Well, again, I think the answer to that is that clearly ALJ Rumler rejected the other restrictions that Ms. Montoya was relying upon. And I think that's clear in her order when she says, I'm not citing all the evidence that I find unpersuasive. And so, I don't think there's much question that you have to conclude from her order that she specifically rejected the limitations or restrictions that were testified to by Dr. Lesnack. I don't think you can come to any other conclusion. I think that's how you have to read that order.
But you would acknowledge that Lesnack's opinion with regard to physical restrictions was not outdated.
It was not outdated. It was rejected by the judge.
Thank you.
So I agree with that. The second issue is, I think even if there was harm in this statement or sentence that we focused on in Judge Rumler's order. Again, the claimant or the respondent's expert specifically agreed that if the ALJ finds that Ms. Shriver's statement of restrictions is credible and she accepts that, then I agree that the claimant is permanently and totally disabled. And again, it's in the record twice where she says that. Finally, you know, we've challenged this reassignment to another judge who didn't hear any evidence, didn't conduct a hearing, and came to completely contrary findings. And
you challenge it for the first time before us. You didn't challenge it before the ALJs below, correct?
I'm not understanding the question.
You didn't raise any objection to the reassignment when it occurred, or at any point during the process before Judge Friend, I believe it was, issued the order. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I think that's accurate to say I didn't object, but it's clear under the comp law that an order that neither grants or denies benefits is not appealable. I didn't have the basis to object. I didn't have the basis to appeal that reassignment. And if you read the order from the ICAO, I'm sure all of you are sharper than I am, but it's very confusing in terms of what the scope of this remand is when you read the order. What the ICAO says in their order of remand is that it's remanded to reconsider the evidence. Now, I don't know if that means to reconsider the evidence regarding this statement that they determined it was not supported by the evidence in the record. And quite frankly, I think the order was ambiguous. For me to have believed that this order of remand allowed a new ALJ without undertaking any hearing, without hearing any evidence, to completely dismiss the credibility determinations that Judge Rumler made after hearing the evidence, that wasn't even on the radar screen in terms of what I thought the scope of this order of remand was.
Counsel, did you expect Judge Friend to refer to Judge Rumler's order?
I did.
Isn't that inconsistent with law from this court about successor judges? Aren't they supposed to go at it from scratch?
Well, they didn't. The judge didn't go at it from scratch. In fact, he had briefs in the record before him that were filed before the ICAO. That wasn't in the record in the hearing. He didn't undertake this matter from scratch. The record included briefs that had been filed before the Industrial Claims Appeals Office. So this wasn't something that he went from scratch. The remand here was contrary to all the case law that says an ALJ's findings of fact and credibility determinations are binding on the ICAO, and they can't just substitute their opinions for that. The cases that I've cited for the court, I think, do raise due process questions. Is this really a fair process to Ms. Hand, who goes to a hearing, has every single evidentiary determination ruled on in her favor, and then the case is remanded to another administrative law judge who then says, no, the claimant's not credible, her treating physician is not credible, her vocational expert is not credible, all without hearing one shred of evidence or without confronting a single witness. I'd like to reserve my remaining time if I could.
Certainly, counsel. You've got about a minute 12.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Caruso. My bar number is 34547, and I'm an attorney at McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney & Carpenter. I represent Peterson Contractors and Excavation, AMS Staff Leasing, GI Global Insurance Company, care of the Colorado Insurance Guarantee Association, and Western Guarantee Fund Services. During the next 15 minutes, I'll give a brief history of the complex procedural history of the case, then specifically address the important issues for appeal that Mr. Girard spoke to. As typical in workers' compensation hearings on the issue of permanent total disability benefits, both parties had vocational consultant experts testify regarding their opinions regarding claimants' ability to earn any wages in the same or other employment. Ms. Shriver testified on behalf of Ms. Hand, and Ms. Montoya testified on behalf of the respondents. Factors that the vocational experts considered included claimant's physical condition, her mental ability, age, employment history, education, and the availability of work that she could perform. It was claimant's burden to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that employment was not available to her under her particular circumstances. Given the significance of the vocational experts, Mr. Girard heavily impeached Ms. Montoya, and I heavily impeached Ms. Shriver. Ms. Montoya and Ms. Shriver's opinions were critical in this case because they went to the very important issue of whether employment was available to claimant in her particular circumstance. Ms. Shriver testified that no, employment was not available. And Ms. Montoya testified that after review of all of the medical opinions that provide the physical restrictions from Ms. Hand, and after her consideration of claimant's employment history and education, that employment was available to claimant. Judge Rumler, in her findings of fact, wrote the statement that I believe Justice Bernard had mentioned, and that was that she relied upon Ms. Shriver's opinions rather than those of Katie Montoya because due to procedural difficulties with this case, beyond the control of Ms. Montoya, she only had outdated physical restrictions. And Judge Rumler awarded claimant permanent total disability benefits. The finding by Judge Rumler was clearly erroneous. The evidence was that Ms. Montoya had current physical restrictions from Dr. Lesnick, and that she also considered Dr. Lockwood's physical restrictions from December 2002, which he again stated in April 2006 had not changed, that Ms. Hand remained the same. Respondents appealed. And the ICAP made very interesting statements in their order, and I'd like to quote from their brief or their order. They said, respondents' vocational expert expressed the opinion that the claimant had the capacity to return to work. This evidence, if credited, might support a finding that the claimant is not entitled to PTD benefits. Therefore, we cannot conclude that the ALJ's misunderstanding of the testimony of respondent's vocational expert was harmless error. Moreover, we are unable to ascertain how the ALJ would have assessed the sufficiency and probative value of the vocational expert's testimony if the ALJ had been aware that the expert did have the most recent physical restrictions, which were even less restrictive than the older restrictions. Consequently, we must remand the case for the ALJ to reconsider the evidence and enter a new order concerning the claimant's entitlement to PTD benefits. There is no specification of what evidence to consider, that the evidence had to be limited during the reconsideration. They were very clear with their directive. So Judge Rumler's order was set aside and remanded, and ALJ Haar issued a procedural order on remand, stating that Judge Rumler was not available and the case was reassigned to Judge Friend. The next day, claimant's counsel filed claimant's notice pursuant to notice of reassignment and a proposed order on remand for consideration by ALJ Friend, and that proposed order included a signature line for ALJ Friend to sign. Shortly thereafter, respondents did the same thing. Judge Friend considered the record, the same record that would have been available to Judge Rumler had she still been on the bench. And Judge Rumler's order, I apologize, he did not consider Judge Rumler's order because that at that time had been set aside and was invalid. After reading the evidence, Judge Friend determined that claimant was not entitled to PTD benefits. Claimant appealed to ICAP, but did not dispute that ALJ Rumler erroneously believed that Ms. Montoya had outdated physical restrictions.
Ms. Caruso?
Yes.
Is the panel not bound by findings of fact for which there is record support?
If the findings of fact are not supported by the evidence?
No, I'm saying if there is record support, any record support for a finding of fact, is this ICAO bound by that?
I think generally the ICAO is bound by findings of fact if there is record support.
Well, how is it then that if they find one finding of fact for which they conclude there is no record support, that they can then order that all of the findings of fact now are eliminated and we start over?
Absolutely. That's a terrific question. I think because in permanent total disability cases, because the big issue is whether the claimant is employable in her circumstances, the whole case turns on what the vocational consultant's opinions are. And so therefore, if the error is in consideration of one vocational consultant, as it was in this case, everything gets kind of tossed up in the air again. How do you consider all of the evidence that was tendered to the court now, once we understand what the evidence was with respect to both of the vocational consultants?
Shouldn't the remand simply have been to reconsider Montoya's testimony and Shriver's testimony and reconsider your finding with regard to the claimant's employability? Wouldn't that have been precisely what needed to happen?
I can't agree with that. And the reason why is because once you reconsider the testimony by Montoya and Shriver, you have to go back then and apply why they came to the opinions that they did. What did they consider? What restrictions did they consider? What were the doctor's testimony, and were the opinions credible? And we have to kind of look at everything all over again just to say, all right, let's go back and let's take a look at these vocational consultants. Let's evaluate which one we like, which one's more credible, and which one we're going to utilize in our opinion. Not much would change in the order. In fact, the consequence of that could have denied respondents appellate right. It could have denied due process to respondents, because I'm not sure that there would have been much of a difference in the result of the case.
I guess my question is, so then the way that you argue the case, the ICAO is bound by findings of fact for which there is record support, unless they find there is not record support for one finding of fact, in which case then they are free to vacate all findings of fact and start over.
In situations like this case, I would agree with that.
And what's the basis for that?
I think that because the evidence with respect to the vocational consultants was so significant that it required a review of all of the evidence.
But it required that all of the findings of fact, even those supported by the record, must be vacated. Is what I mean, that's the foundation of your argument, is that in effect the ICAO's order is all findings of fact are hereby vacated, go back and do it again. And you're saying it's necessary here, but do they really have the authority to do that?
Well, I think that under the statute, if evidence is not supported by the record, they have the authority to remand. And in this case, there was no objection by opposing counsel that the remand should be limited, that the directive on remand was clear, that they should reconsider, that the judge should reconsider the evidence and issue an order on permanent total disability.
Well, did they have any idea that that's what the judge was going to do? I mean, how did anybody know that this judge, upon reviewing the case, was going to simply abandon all previous findings of fact?
I think that when you read ICAP's second order, it's at least implied in that order that that's what they anticipated would happen.
And but they couldn't appeal it at that time, could they? I mean, if the claimant at that time didn't like the ICAO order, that was not a final order, was it? Could they have appealed it?
No, they could not have appealed the ICAO order. But the issue, I think, is the order of remand by Judge Haar and the reassignment to Judge Friend. I think that's...
So what they could have done is objected to the assignment to Judge Friend?
Right. And I think that their argument is, well, we should have been entitled a de novo hearing or a new hearing. But they never objected. They never stated any issue on the record. They presented Judge Friend an order that said, hey, we want you to agree with Judge Rumler and make these additional findings with respect to the vocational evaluators, and we'll go from there. Respondents sent a proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order to Judge Friend, and laid it on the line and said, hey, reconsider all of the evidence. It's been remanded for your consideration of the evidence and a determination of permanent total disability benefits. There still never was a motion to strike, never an objection. And in claimant's own briefs, it's the Bell versus Great Lakes case. Granted, it's an Oklahoma case, and so it can only be persuasive here, but that case says it must be noted that the case requires a new trial or trial de novo be requested by the party. And here it wasn't. And in fact, in that case, the parties indicated harmony and therefore with respect to the new judge issuing an order, which therefore constituted a stipulation for the new judge to proceed, which is similar to our case as well.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Ms. Caruso. I understand your argument that this wasn't raised below and that there is some sort of forfeiture or waiver going. Let's set that aside for just a moment if we can. Assuming for the purposes of argument that you've told us here that the real fulcrum of this case was the disagreement among the vocational experts, and that was very central and very important. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, why doesn't that suggest that the proper thing to do on remand is to have another hearing at which both these people testify in order to be able to assess their credibility? In other words, isn't the right thing to do here, the appropriate thing to do on remand, to have a hearing where both of them would testify, and then if it's the original ALJ or the successor ALJ, at least there's an ability to make the appropriate credibility determinations?
Your Honor, not under Big Top versus Hoffman. The Supreme Court was very clear in 1965 in that case, which has been followed consistently and repetitively throughout the years, and it continues to be followed. And in that case, the Supreme Court established that one who decides without a hearing an administrative matter should at least read and consider the evidence not taken in his presence.
But counsel, Big Top's not a remand case. Big Top is not a case where there was an original complete hearing and then an appeal, and then it's turned around and sent back down, particularly on an issue where credibility is so important. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, yes, you are, Your Honor.
And even if it were applicable, I mean, doesn't the Supreme Court use the words at least? And so in any given case, couldn't the correct result, the due process result, be at least isn't enough here? You've got to have a new hearing.
Your Honor, I agree that the Supreme Court uses the word at least, but I do think that at least was enough here, because Judge Friend's order is very thorough and it's very meticulous about the evidence. And he did go through all of the evidence, all of the doctors, and he said who he deemed credible and who he didn't and why, as opposed to Judge Rumler's order. I don't think that Judge Friend made any shortcuts. And I do think that the at least, at a minimum, was done here, and I do think that due process was respected.
Thank you, counsel. You're out of time. I appreciate your argument.
Now, Mr. Girard,
yes.
I, I know you have something in mind where you want to start, but I have a question, so don't lose what you have in mind.
Okay.
Well, let's say that this never went to Judge Friend. Let's say that this went back to Judge Rumler. Couldn't Judge Rumler have revisited all of her findings of fact and simply say, you know, I've reconsidered all of the evidence as required by the ICAO for me to reconsider? I've reconsidered it, and I've changed my mind. Why couldn't she have done that?
Well, number one, again, I don't think that the ICAO can take one isolated fact and remand for complete redetermination of the facts where there's clearly record support for her findings in the first instance. And in this particular case, she could have relied solely on the claimant's testimony. The law is clear in workers' compensation. You don't need an expert to opine regarding whether or not someone's permanently and totally disabled. You don't need a medical expert to establish that. So ALJ Rumler could have relied solely on the claimant's testimony, which she found credible. She said if she could work, she'd be working. I'm convinced of that. That alone could have been the basis for her determination. Dr. Woodcock's testimony, his testimony alone, without regard to Doris Shriver's testimony, without regard to the claimant's testimony, that testimony alone, which there's no dispute that it was supported by substantial evidence, could have supported the order in and of itself. And that's the unfairness in the remand here. I don't think there's much question if this was remanded to Judge Rumler what she would have done with it based upon the fact that she didn't even talk about Dr. Lesnack's testimony. Thank you, Your
Thank
Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. This concludes our arguments for this afternoon. This case will be deemed submitted, and we shall issue an opinion in it in due course. If the bailiff would please announce the recess.
Court will be in recess subject to call.